From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters News Agency, and Tim Mack, senior correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump issued a new stream of controversial statements on abortion, nuclear nonproliferation, the laws of war, and whether he would support another Republican nominee. Taken together, these comments increase speculation that the Republican convention will be contested. President Obama convened his final nuclear security summit, aiming to safeguard nuclear material from criminals and terrorists, especially the group that calls itself the Islamic State. French police arrested another ISIS suspect in possession of the same kind of conventional explosives used in recent terrorist attacks in France and Belgium. And scientists warn that the West Antarctic ice sheet could melt within decades, causing devastation to New York and other coastal cities by the turn of the next century. Serious news, Tim. Let's start with Donald Trump, who I'm sure understands all of these issues perfectly. The latest controversy with him began on the MSNBC network. He was asked about abortion and what would happen if abortion was made illegal. And Trump said that he would have to have some form of punishment, quote, unquote, for women who have abortions. Now, he later retracted that statement, but coming on top of all the other things he said about women, it did stir up a little bit of controversy, didn't it?
Well, there are a couple points here to be made, right? The first is that he has historically terrible ratings amongst that women typically do not like Donald Trump. Within the Republican electorate, it's a little better. Among the general population, it's a little worse. And this certainly is going to hurt him should he become the nominee and run for general election against Hillary Clinton. Second point to be made is his statements show a total lack of historical interest or knowledge about the pro-life movement in America and the very conservatives he's trying to get the support of right now. That the pro-life movement for a very long time has tried to take the attitude and the line that even though they oppose abortion, it's not about punishing the woman who chooses to have an abortion. It's about punishing the method, and it's about banning the method, and perhaps if there is any punishment at all, it goes to the providers of abortion. And so immediately after Donald Trump said that, he was met with a smattering of opposition from every major pro-life organization in America. A hailstorm from every major pro-life organization in America, which if he had been listening to them at all for the last 30 or 40 years, he would know and understand that that's not the attitude and that's not the line that they've been trying to push this entire time.
Yeah. Arshad, you sort of see a similar pattern with his comments on foreign policy. One gets a sense that he hasn't really thought through, and I was particularly struck, given that we've been having this nuclear security summit and so on, with his comments on nuclear weapons, which he made, I think, in a town hall on CNN a few days ago, that basically he's okay. And not even okay, but maybe it's a good idea if Japan and South Korea and even Saudi Arabia were to get nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it was an interesting comment, and it did stir up controversy, particularly in the foreign policy elite. And it struck a pretty sharp contrast in the middle of a nuclear security summit, which is really all about trying to prevent the spread of both nuclear weapons, but also nuclear materials. By raising the idea that South Korea and Japan, longtime U.S. allies, could get their own nuclear arsenals, and suggesting that might be a good idea, what he's essentially done is set the stage, at least in the view of some analysts, for the possibility of nuclear weapons proliferating much more widely. And the basic view of kind of nuclear theorists is that the fewer countries that have nuclear weapons, the better. The less unstable the strategic environment is, the less chances of mistakes or errors or catastrophe. The last thing that I think is worth saying about this is that the White House really did not pull any punches when Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor, was asked about Trump's comments. And remember, White Houses try not to get too involved in American politics. He said that it would be catastrophic if there were to be nuclear proliferation of this sort. So that kicked up a lot of fuss.
Indeed. I want to mention one other thing, Arshad, that Trump had to say about foreign policy. He was asked about the Geneva Conventions, which, of course, as we know, are a number of sort of rules of war that prohibit torture and various behaviors that that are considered inappropriate even in a wartime setting. And he said, quote, "The problem is we have the Geneva Conventions, all sorts of rules and regulations, so the soldiers are afraid to fight." Anything you could say about that?
Those comments come on top of things that he said earlier in the campaign, notably about the possibility of bringing back waterboarding and a whole lot worse. I think there are two things to be said here. One is that in terms of the domestic American audience, his comments might not be as controversial as you might think. We Reuters and Ipsos released a poll this week which showed that nearly two-thirds of Americans, 63%, felt that torture is acceptable in some circumstances. 25% said that it was often justified, and 38% said that it was sometimes justified. And only 15% said that it was never justified. So Trump might be a little closer to the pulse of the nation, at least based on that polling data. The other thing, though, that analysts question about such statements, you know, they point to, for example, the fact of putting the Guantanamo Bay inmates in the bright orange uniforms, a motif that groups like Islamic State and others have picked up in keeping American prisoners in such, you know, garb. And the point they make, and I've had U.S. officials make to me for more than a decade, is basically anything that the United States does to people as a matter of policy, other countries, groups, individuals will do to U.S. citizens, then that this is a very slippery and dangerous slope.
Indeed. Tim, you were saying that people at Trump rallies are eagerly anticipating the return of waterboarding.
Yeah, I think that there's a sense that the rules aren't fair for Americans when they're sent off to war. That when you look at the Islamic State and ISIS, They have no rules. They don't subscribe to the Geneva Conventions. They're beheading people. They're putting people in cages, like the Jordanian pilot putting them in a cage and setting them on fire. They're absolutely barbaric. And there is a sense, there's a very visceral sense, that we should strike back in kind. Now, of course, there are reasons for these rules, that America plays by these rules because we're a more civilized, developed mentality. But I think amongst people who are at Trump rallies, who are Trump supporters, the American military is being held back not by only by the Geneva Convention, but also by restrictive rules of engagement. The war against ISIS and the amount of airstrikes, the daily sorties that are happening in Iraq and Syria are insufficient to really weaken the Islamic States in a way that is fast enough for their liking. Basically, what Donald Trump is bringing to them is this idea that we can hit back harder, we can change the rules, we can be less restrained. Mm-hmm. And there's an appetite for that. There's a very significant appetite.
It characterizes, you know, during this CNN town hall when he was asked why he had attacked or retweeted an unflattering picture of his rival Ted Cruz's wife, he said, well, he started it. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, as of course the moderator put it, that's a 5-year-old's argument.
But it's still very dizzyingly
that, you know, if somebody hits you, you have to hit back harder, and in the context of international relations, that does cause pause. One other comment on Trump before we move on to other issues. I've read a couple commentaries suggesting that he has, quote-unquote, jumped the shark. I want you to define that for our listeners, that he's going to face, to use another analogy, his Waterloo in the Wisconsin primary because he is trailing Ted Cruz badly, and it appears that sort of the cumulative effect of all of these controversial things he said are, you know, finally beginning to show in the polls, even for Republicans.
Well, by jumping the shark, you mean that his moment has passed, that his apex has arrived and he's going to begin a slow decline.
Thank you.
So there has been a lot of commentary about how this is it for Donald Trump. But there's been that commentary since the very beginning of this campaign, when he started out his campaign calling Mexicans rapists, when he said that John McCain wasn't a hero because he was captured as a prisoner of war. He said plenty of insulting and controversial things through the entire course of his campaign. And I think at this point, what the polling shows is his supporters are going to stick with him no matter what.
But there are fewer of them, perhaps, than there were before.
There will probably be fewer of them unless he can manage to change the tide during a general election campaign. At this point, though, he has such a large lead in delegates. He's going to lead the Republican field going into a convention. Now, on Tuesday, it looks like he is going to lose in Wisconsin. So what does that mean for Donald Trump? That means that over the course of the rest of the campaign, he needs to win 60% of the remaining delegates in order to avoid a contested convention when we go to Cleveland in July. That's very difficult to do. So what we're going to find is we're going to find for the first time since the 70s, the Republican Party is not going to have its nominee before we get to the convention. There's going to be a lot of drama, a lot of classical politicking behind closed doors. It's going to be very interesting to see how this all turns out, and Donald Trump is going to have to really fight for the nomination.
Fascinating, fascinating. I want to turn now back to the issue of nuclear weapons, Arshad, the Nuclear Security Summit. President Obama has made this issue, in fact, made nuclear nonproliferation an issue since he came in. He gave a famous speech in 2009 in Prague where he kind of rhapsodized about a world without nuclear weapons and so on. This is the final of these summits. And the White House has been releasing kind of a constant stream of facts and factoids about various accomplishments. What have these summits really achieved, and what haven't they achieved?
So two things. One, talking about the issue of, you know, getting hit and hitting back. In terms of nuclear weapons generally, the world has actually, post-Hiroshima, enjoyed remarkable stability. No further use of nuclear weapons, and nation states can easily be deterred from using nuclear weapons. North Korea, for example, which is a big topic at the summit, has tested nuclear devices four times, but it's never actually used a nuclear weapon. This summit is much more, though, about securing nuclear materials. That is to say, radioactive materials like highly enriched uranium or plutonium, which could be used in a nuclear bomb, or isotopes that are used in hospitals or for medical purposes. The fear is that those kinds of materials can be put into dirty bombs wrapped with a conventional explosive that can have much longer lasting effects than a conventional bomb, which might kill a certain number of people. But a dirty bomb can make whole areas uninhabitable for long periods. Yes, Obama's made this a kind of a signature issue, and it's clear that it has had some effect in terms of trying to decrease the amount of nuclear material that is out there and increasing the security of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. What's left, yeah.
Yep. That said, you know, analysts argue that it hasn't gone as far as it might. One big kind of elephant that's not in the room at this summit is the fact that Russia didn't come, and yeah. Russia is a key player in trying to maintain this kind of security. The other fundamental
Why
question...
Why didn't Russia come?
Well, their stated reason is that there wasn't enough cooperation with the United States in advance of the summit on setting the agenda. Most analysts that I've talked to and U.S. officials think it's part of the wider deterioration in U.S.-Russian relations over a whole host of issues, not
Ukraine.
Least of all Ukraine, mm-hmm. Syria, et cetera. The fundamental question is, does this effort, if not die when Obama leaves office, does it get far less attention and emphasis in the next White House? If it does, then you could see some diminution. Potentially, it's conceivable that you could see nuclear materials becoming more insecure and more available, or just that they're not as well protected as they might be. And I think that's a very open question now, is what does the next president do about this?
Yeah. Tim Arshad was talking about stockpiles of highly enriched uranium and so on. A lot of it has been given up. A lot of countries, I think something like 14 countries, have agreed to give up all of this material, and they're converting so-called research reactors so they can use low-enriched uranium. These reactors were kind of passed out like candy in the 50s and the 60s by the United States, by the Soviet Union, later by China, and they're used to make medical isotopes mm-hmm. and to do research as well. China has now moved to take back this material from a number of countries in Africa and also in Syria, and it's getting help in converting these reactors. So that's one of the good things. There's also more border security. I think I saw something from the White House, something like 359 new border detection facilities or something like that. Is there still the possibility that somebody could get into one of these facilities and get their hands on some of this material?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, considering how necessary these materials are for medical research and medical treatment throughout the world, it's always possible that there can be some sort of compromise in security and that sort of weapon could be created. I don't think it's likely. And I think stepping back a little bit, we have to take a look at whether or not the world is more secure today from a nuclear standpoint than it was in 2009. I think it's a toss-up, and the president's legacy on this will depend on how the Iran nuclear deal works. It will depend on whether North Korea could be dissuaded from further developing nuclear weapons, which it looks like it's unlikely to do, whether there will be any sort of proliferation on the low end, like what we're talking about, on those materials that could be used for an unconventional nuclear weapon. And, of course, the deteriorating relationship with Russia and how the previous pacts on nuclear weapons have not been very successful.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are going to factor into whether or not President Obama is seen as a leader in this issue.
Time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAnews.com.
Visit VOAnews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Arshad Mohammed and Tim Mak. One other point before we leave the nuclear summit was at an event with former Defense Secretary Bill Perry, who was quite ominous in suggesting he thought it was quite probable that some nuclear material might be grabbed by a terrorist group or others in the near future. And he and also California Governor Jerry Brown, who's taken this issue on, both said that it was imperative, Arshad, for the United States to improve its relationship with Russia,
mm-hmm.
And that the two really had to work together to get a handle on this, since obviously these are the two powers with the most nuclear weapons and the biggest nuclear arsenals. But I want to move on to the issue of terrorism per se, and that is a new arrest, really frightening. I mean, this was on the inside pages of our newspapers, which is incredible. Tim and Arshad, Rita Cricket, a 34-year-old Frenchman, was arrested in a suburb of Paris. They raided an apartment that he had rented under a fake name, and they found an arsenal of weapons and explosives of unprecedented size, including a TATP, which is the material, the explosive that was used in the suicide bombs used in Paris last November and in Brussels in March, along with Kalashnikov, submachine gun, steel balls, stolen French passports, cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. Arshad, should we feel comforted by this arrest, or should we feel even more terrified?
Well, the most startling thing to me was after that arrest, the French prosecutor in charge of the case said that he believed that Mr. Cricket was planning imminent attacks. You know, it's hard to say whether one should be more afraid or less afraid. I was in Europe last week, not in Brussels, but in both Paris and London immediately after the Brussels attacks, whose death toll I think has now gone to 35. And you could see how immediately the government officials and police and other security forces' anxieties and vigilance level shot right up. I mean, I saw what appeared to me to be army soldiers with, you know, automatic weapons in the Louvre Museum, as tourists are wandering around, which is jarring. Much, much higher security at airports and at train stations, both of which, I was at. And the fundamental question that it leaves open is, you know, is there more to come? And is this just a feature of life that people in Europe and possibly in the United States are going to have to live with? The other comment I would make is that my impression was that people just went on and lived their lives as best they could. Subways were not all that much, weren't empty by any means. And, you know, it may be that this is starting to get priced into the equation for people.
Incredible. Tim, has there been much progress in finding the rest of the people in Belgium? There were reports of a third man at the airport, the man in white with the black hat. They thought they caught him, and apparently they didn't. So it's entirely likely that there's still more of these people out there, yeah?
There are, and there was an AP report earlier last week in which they described hundreds of ISIS-trained individuals who are trying to currently infiltrate Europe. It was a terrifying report, but with not a ton of detail. And what that does is it does create fear in the general population, which is precisely what the so-called Islamic State wants to do. There's been a lot of frustration amongst U.S. intelligence and national security sources about what happened in Belgium, that they felt that they gave as much warning and intelligence that they could have to the Belgian authorities before that attack,
mm-hmm.
And that they really give off the sense that they were aware that this was imminent and was coming, and that the Belgian authorities failed to properly step up security in advance of such warnings. And you get the sense that the United States is doing everything that it can from an intelligence sharing standpoint, from a cooperation standpoint, in order to try to prevent activities of this nature from happening again. And you'll find that behind the scenes, there's quite a lot of American involvement.
There do seem to be some patterns, Arshad. There seem to be brothers working together. A lot of these people, including this Reda Kriket, have extensive criminal records. Mm-hmm. And many of them appear, at least in France, Belgium, to be second or third generation with parents from North Africa. Particularly Morocco seems to figure heavily. So, you know, it would seem that even if you just monitor people who've come out of prison, with similar profiles, you would have some better opportunity of getting a handle on it.
It's possible. One of the big challenges, by all accounts, in Belgium is the relative weakness of the Belgian central state or the federal state, because of the divisions between the French-speaking and the Dutch-speaking or Flemish-speaking parts of Belgium. There's been a really powerful trend toward kind of local responsibility for things, and the federal state does not have either the resources or, in some cases, the authorities. And that suggests that it might be a longer and harder fix, because it's one thing in the United States where you have, and you remember President George W. Bush had, there was a tremendous battle over creating the
Department of Homeland Security.
Department of Homeland Security, exactly. And he was accused of seeking dictatorial powers and so on. But ultimately, the federal government, you know, did create this department. And however well or poorly it functions, at least there's an address and a person you can hold accountable for these things. And it may be something of a challenge for weaker states to try to impose that kind of order.
Mm-hmm. What about Interpol?
Candidly, I don't know much about Interpol. Mm-hmm.
Because this is supposed to be the European police. Well, yep. It's the international police, I guess, but it's based in Europe. And again, in terms of tracking people who, you know, have gone as foreign fighters, and that's mm-hmm. another aspect. Not all of them, but many of them had gone to Syria or Iraq and then come mm-hmm. back to Europe, that you would be able to at least have a database of foreign fighters. I mean, mm-hmm. that would seem like a relative no-brainer. Mm-hmm. But I want to turn, before we run out of time, to one other issue, which is perhaps the biggest threat facing all of us and very rarely gets the attention it deserves. But it was on the front pages recently, Tim, and that is the question of the Great Antarctic Ice Sheet. This is larger than Mexico. And apparently it is cracking and melting faster than had even been assumed. It may raise the sea level by as much as 6 feet by 2100, which would be a catastrophe of unprecedented scope for coastal cities.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons why it's not getting the kind of coverage that that ISIS gets is it's not an imminent threat. We're thinking about much longer time trajectories here.
It's not that long away, though.
Well, in terms of getting blown up by a terrorist in Paris tomorrow or 100 or, you know, where sea level rises over the course of the next 80, 90 years. But yeah, it's absolutely a threat. And the question is, there are, I guess, a couple major questions that come to mind. The question is whether or not the progress in climate change and the general trend towards global warming can be halted at this point, given human preferences and the development of technologies, whether that can even be halted. And we can stop the ice shells from melting. And I guess the second question is whether or not humans can find a way to adapt, create technologies that allow us to hold back the rising sea levels or reduce the levels of carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah,
those are interesting questions that over the next 80 years there'll be a lot of engineers trying to address.
I think it's probably going to have to be a combination of both, of trying to stop it and reverse it and deal with the necessary adaptation to what is already happening. But that is all the time we have today. Joining us were Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters News Agency, and Tim Mak, senior correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Silevsky. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.